Welcome to the Philacrosophy Podcast, where host and lacrosse expert Jamie Monroe will do what he does best, talk about lacrosse. Each episode will provide listeners with education, insights, stories, and lessons about the lacrosse world. We will discuss current events, coaching, philosophies, and college lacrosse recruiting. Now let's get started with your host, Jamie Monroe.
How's it going, everybody? Really excited to welcome Chris Fifes to the Philacrosophy Podcast. Chris is the head coach at the University of Vermont, going into his eighth season. And Chris, couldn't be more excited to have you on the show, finally. We go back a long ways. I remember you as a recruit, tried to get you interested in Denver, and then had the pleasure of getting to know you when you coached my son Colin at Carolina. And you had a really impact on my life also, because you helped my daughter find a home at the University of Oregon with Katrina Dowd. I owe you big time. So thanks for coming on the show.
Awesome. Thanks for having me, Jamie. I also vividly remember, you know, seeing you out in Denver, and you've had an enormous impact on my lacrosse career and just how I look at the game. And I really enjoy speaking to you every time. I feel like I learned something new. So I'm excited to be here.
Awesome, man. Hey, congratulations on the baby boy.
Thank you very much. That's right. That's right. Really excited to be a daddy now. And as I said, I'm a little late to the party, you know, but it's really cool every day to go home. It's a new adventure every day. So I'm excited to raise him around my current group of cats.
Awesome, man. Love it. All right, let's dig in. You're in your eighth season. So tell me how your sort of philosophies on even being a head coach has changed from the time that you first got there, when your head was spinning and you're trying to do everything perfectly, to now where you're still trying to do everything perfectly, but maybe you've got a little bit of a different view on it. How do you view just that, the role of a head coach now versus when you started?
Well, I feel like lacrosse, I've always been playing catch up, just having grown up in North Carolina. You know, I was able to just get by being athletic and being, you know, physically bigger than a lot of kids, but I didn't have the best IQ, and I, you know, didn't really see a ton of great competition as I did later in college and the guys that I played with in practice every day. But I've also been very fortunate to have some great coaches and mentors to learn from. And I think as I was playing catch up, I just try to do what they told me to do or emulate what my teammates did. And so as I've moved forward, I would just kind of rely on the experience where I had just been, you know, at whether it be at prep school, you know, or whether it be at University of Maryland, or whether it be at VMI or North Carolina. I've always had some really good coaches around me to learn from and emulate. So when I became a head coach, I just continued on that pattern. And I felt like I would just copy what we did at Carolina with Coach Bresci. You know, obviously had a lot of success there. But, you know, after like a year of trying to run the same early offense that Jimmy Bitter and Joey Sankey and Marcus Holman and those guys did, you know, I quickly learned that that wasn't going to work here. And the answer was not to copy everything that I had done previously. It was to figure out what would work the best at Vermont for the players that I have and the type of players that I could recruit, and also the coaches that I had on my staff. How could I play to their strengths as well? So after our first season where we didn't even make the conference tournament, it was a pretty demoralizing flight home from UMBC, and really had to do some soul searching and figure out, you know, how I could bring more to the table as a head coach. And really, I think it started with just discipline, you know, demanding a lot out of my players from a consistency level at practice, the little details that could really strengthen our culture, because the culture is what drives the winning here. The culture is what allows us to take on the elements and to take on the travel and to take on, you know, being road warriors. The culture is what allows us to maintain consistency and be successful. So with that, that discipline, we had to kind of develop, you know, what is our team motto? What are our team views? Our team motto is team before self, and our team values are discipline, respect, and gratitude. So really trying to embody those values and really trying to be a selfless teammate and a selfless coach. I realized that to achieve great things at Vermont, we really needed to be a sum of our parts. We weren't going to have the five-star athlete here. We weren't going to be able to beat juggernaut teams like Albany with just, you know, one good player, you know. So really trying to find guys that could complement each other and be a really dynamic team. And so the recruiting philosophy changed a little bit. How we structured practice changed a little bit. Our emphasis of how we could build a strong culture changed a little bit. And, you know, 7 years later, I feel like we've strengthened our culture, and the culture is the thing I'm most proud of. And that's what really feeds this whole thing and gets me excited to come to practice every morning at 6 a.m.
Love it. How about from a defensive perspective, how have you sort of evolved from, you know, like you said, your Carolina defense coordinators, yeah, where you played things a certain way to now?
I mean, if I'm being brutally honest, I was not a very good defensive coach compared to where I am now. I've learned more as a head coach than I've learned all my other coaching years combined, just because you have to live and die on every decision that you make. And there is no safety net and there is no one else that's going to save you. So you really got to do your due diligence and you need to prepare a lot more thoroughly. And I learned a tremendous amount from Jake Bernhardt, who was with me here for 6 years. We talked a lot about offense and defense, and he helped me with a few little things that I struggled with, you know, in terms of off ball play that really helped me connect all the dots defensively. And well, where we slid from on certain scenarios, you know, why we did the certain things that we did, you know, not creating offense, you know, not being so obsessed with sliding, and really, in fact, trying not to slide, really trying to be a team that forces low angle and low percentage opportunities and slides only when you need to, and really trying to develop your identity of being a big boy defense that doesn't slide to your poles. We're not gimmicky. We don't create offense for other teams. We really try to make them earn everything. And so there's just some things that we do strategically that I think, especially in the shot clock era, allow us to force the shots that we want to see. So it took some time, you know, for that to come together, but we went from a team that didn't make the conference tournament in 2017 to having, I think, the 12th ranked defense in the country in 2018. It just so happened that Albany had an incredible team with Connor Fields, Tahoka, number one offense in the country, a lot of really good players, TD Ireland, to feed that juggernaut offense that could really just expose our defense. But aside from them, we had a really good defense that year, and it's really started to click for me at that point. So defensively, I think we want to be a very simplistic defense that wins with speed of play and wins with consistency and understands that we can be interchangeable, that we're not so matchup conscious. Again, that we're winning matchups and forcing people to areas that we want them to be.
How much more reading react are you now than you were when you came in as a head coach?
Much more, much more. Very big on slide recognition, something that I have really tried to refine over time. I think everything is slide recognition, reading the on-ball defender, reading where they are in proximity to the cage, reading on the time and the shot clock, those type of things. It's really important that you have great slide recognition. Another example of that would be, you know, how you run, say, an invert zone. Whereas maybe if you're running an invert zone that's predicated on changing the matchup as quickly as you can, say you have a face-off guy or an offensive midi caught in a single invert scenario, and you're just so obsessed with changing that matchup and sliding. I remember back in, I think it was 2015 or 16, when we played Denver at home at Carolina, one of the first games of the season. It was a tie game going into overtime, and they had the ball. They called a timeout, and they went into a single invert. We went into a single invert zone, and we slid when we didn't need to slide, and they just banged it, you know, two times, and they kicked it to the backside, and they scored a hands-free, you know, lefty goal from Zach Miller, I think it was, to score the game winner. And so I just didn't understand at that time that, like, yes, the zone was correct. Yes, we did it correctly, but why are we still giving up these goals? And it's like slide recognition and is crucial. And just like lacrosse IQ is crucial. And you got to empower your defense to understand what are the scenarios where we need to help and what are the scenarios that we need to trust our on ball.
That tells where they are on the field, the matchup, the shot clock. Did they get a chunk? Was it a long approach or a short approach? Was it a skip pass? Are these all the sort of things that you're having the kids look at?
Exactly. You hit the nail on the head.
What about, you know, the slide decision as it relates to the other off ball defenders? I mean, are you trying to have everybody read the same thing so that they can be in sync as to whether to collapse or surround the crease? In other words, if the second slider is reading the same thing the slider is reading, is that part of what you're trying to accomplish with regard to the read and react?
So it's interesting. I'm more focused on with off-ball defense, really looking away and like getting a good point of contact, getting a good point of attack, designating a hot guy so that we know we have someone that can help that confrontation. But the other four guys, essentially, whether it be the adjacent guy on the pipe or whether it be the backside three on the help side, I want them to position themselves kind of geographically, more so focused on ball side or help side. If we're a help side defense, if we're on the help side of a defense, we're really not matchup conscious at that point. We're really trying to cover landmarks. So if teams are going to skip the ball, we know where the skips are going to. So we can read and react based on where we're forcing them, their looks to go. So teams are really good at, obviously, when you do that, screening your two slide or screening your rotation and making it tough for you to help because you are kind of quote unquote one dimensional in that regard. But I don't have them ball watch. I really want them, in fact, looking away as much as possible. And really just being more buttoned up on the help side as it relates to the level of the ball, being level or lower than the ball off ball, forcing perimeter passes, denying skip passes, and really just being crease conscious with forcing outside the paint shots.
When you say look away, though, do you mean head on a swivel or do you mean literally look away?
I mean big eye man, little eye ball. So you're really focused on your man and what he's doing, if they're doing an exchange or if he's sealing you or if he's going to cut to drag you to a certain area so that you can communicate and exchange to your adjacent defenseman. I really want them more so staring at their man and taking a peek at the ball. And then once they recognize the ball has swung through what we call the Rideau line or the median of the defense, flipping your hips, opening to the ball, flipping your hips so that you can be flowing with the ball as the ball moves. So the only guy on our defense that has his back turned to the ball is the guy that's covering the crease. Everybody else is opening to the ball as it moves.
Mm-hmm. And as far as second slides and stuff, is it a community effort or is it a designated thing? And then how do you time up a second slide with your big eye man, little eye ball, or is it a situation where you can see from a matchup or a situation that you need to sort of change that percentage of man and ball, big eye, little eye, the other way?
Yeah. I mean, listen, that saying sounds crazy, but I took it from Brian Holman and his time at Johns Hopkins, and it always stuck with me. It depends on if it's an open set or depends on if they have a single crease or a double crease. All of those have different kind of implications. If it's an open set and they're running a pair set, for instance, we may designate a crease guy and have him be the person that rotates to throwbacks. Also, is it a hard ball side pop behind the dodge or is it a high follow behind the dodge? That can dictate whether we rotate to a throwback from the crease or whether we rotate from the two pass away guy. Mm-hmm. So depending on, again, for me, the anchor is kind of ball side, help side. Where is that adjacent guy going to fill space? And that's how we'll determine who we rotate from, rather than just letting them dictate who we rotate from. We use our landmarks a lot more, I feel like, than we let them dictate with their spacing.
Love it. What's your take on pressure? How much do you like to apply pressure? What does ball pressure mean to you in your defense? And how often do you actually like really crank it up?
That's a great question. I do remember, you know, I've never seen a defensive coach like you who was so good at pressuring the adjacents and chasing people around the field and making it really hard for teams to spin the ball and to get into a flow. And so that always stuck with me, you know, your Denver defenses. In the shot clock era, I feel like you've got to be really smart with pressure. You know, now finally offenses have to come to us. I don't think there's a huge payoff with chasing guys around and trying to take the ball away, whether, you know, I think the stick technology and also, you know, the probability of you causing a foul and getting scored on, it really, to me, it doesn't, you know, push me to want to put more ball pressure, throw more checks. If anything, we want to be, you know, leading with six, keeping pressure in the gloves, but ball pressure to me could be, you know, more so in short shot clock scenarios. So under 15 seconds, if we have a ball, maybe we press adjacents or, you know, if we're in a big little scenario and we want to control the flow of the ball, we may press the adjacent so they can only swing the ball upfield or do things like that. Mm-hmm. But in terms of just like on ball, basic first layer of the offense, we're really not pressuring a whole lot. We're just trying to kind of maintain matchups and not give them any easy mismatches or any easy leverage because we're lazy with pick play or we create offense for them by sliding.
Yep. Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, there's all different levels. You can dial pressure up, and sometimes you just dial it up in practice just because you want your offense to figure it out. I mean, at the end of the day, in order to win a close game, you're going to have to either apply or deal with heavy pressure, right? Because you have to win the game by doing that, by getting the ball back or not letting the team get it back. But I totally agree with you. In the shot clock era, you can let them come to you a little bit, and you don't want to create offense for people, but there's times to dial it up where, you know, you don't let them throw to X, or, you know, that you definitely need some ball pressure on feeder's hands, right? I mean, that's the poke and lift piece, but you don't have to go outside of the scope of your own athleticism either to be able to do that. You don't have to chase people all over the place to do that.
To your point, we just scrimmaged Yale this past Sunday. And one thing that really stood out to me was how aggressive their poles were. I mean, they were not only incredibly athletic, but incredibly aggressive with just short, just consistent, just pestering checks. And it was very uncomfortable for our guys to running around the perimeter, just spinning the ball or getting the ball from the rope unit to the offense. Like, they're not making anything easy. And so I do think there's a lot of value if you have that type of personnel to play to that personnel, because teams are just going to throw the ball away. They're just going to make terrible decisions, and you're going to force them to play faster than they really want to play. So I do think there's a lot of merit to it when the time, and you have the players to do it.
Yeah. Well, and I think also you can pressure people, even at different times of a game. You know, early in a game, you pressure somebody, they don't care, they'll run right by you and score. But you know what? As soon as the coaches are like, hey, you got to take care of the ball here, now all of a sudden you're trying to take care of the ball and deal with some pressure, and you're not actually playing as loose as you did in the first quarter. Once it's the third quarter and you're up three and you want to like start trying to win this game, all of a sudden the turnovers happen a lot more frequently. But that is interesting that those guys are doing that. I mean, pressure in every sport, right? I mean, there's not a sport where pressure hasn't been utilized in the teams that can do it. But it's not natural.
It's not. You know, I love the man down pressure, the random figure out who the trigger is, or find a corner where you know the weak link and press that corner. I mean, we do two ends of power play at practices, and I generally go with kind of our younger guys, and I work with the younger man down or the younger man up. We call them our ice unit, or a black ice unit, and we throw in random pressure on the corners, and it's incredibly impactful and uncomfortable for them because they can't run their play in a 30-second shot clock. I love that random pressure for a temporary, it's like a floating shot almost. It's really, really, really impactful.
Yeah. And it can really throw teams for a loop, because a lot of people, you know, they don't practice against pressure enough. And so therefore, like, they will just, you know, throw it away. And in a game, like I said, it's like 10-man rides, you know, in practice. And, you know, the second team can beat your 10-man ride all day, but in a game, you know, it's very different when all of a sudden, you know, you're under that type of pressure. Pretty interesting.
Yeah.
You know, you mentioned Jake Bernhardt with you for 6 years. How let's talk a little offense here and talk about your new staff and how you guys have transitioned from, you know, when you first got there, offensive thinking to now.
Yeah. So, you know, when we got to Vermont and the roster that we inherited, we didn't have a lot of initiators that could win their matchup individually, like run by short sticks that had two hands, right? Even the guys that could were pretty one-handed. So it was easy to kind of scout them and maybe force them to make decisions with their offhand. So we had to figure out other ways to draw slides. First of all, early on, we just try to win with defense and squeak out single goal victories type of thing. But as we got a little bit older and we continued to get some guys that could initiate, we just transitioned to more wing dodging. We kind of went from like an umbrella north-south dodging approach, very traditional. Everyone's kind of running that, you know, dodge, follow, fade, crash the backside type of look. That was just very easy for the players to understand the reads, but also is one that defenses are pretty familiar with. So it didn't really give us a ton of variability. But as time went on and we got into 2019, so 2018 was a little bit of a mixture. We had Ian McKay, who was phenomenal and did a phenomenal job just drawing a ton of attention. To 2019, we didn't have Ian McKay, and we had to do a lot more wing dodging to draw slides. So we did a lot of wing dodging, a lot of two-man game, you know, really kind of dodging to the pipe, seeing if they were going to, you know, come from a hedge from X to get us some leverage specs, or if they weren't, you know, getting a finishing in front. So we did a lot more wing dodging in 2019 to just create offense for ourselves and just try to be really creative with our off-ball movement, whether it be going from a single crease to a double crease, single crease to an open crease, just trying to make it uncomfortable for defenses to get set up, and little smoke and mirrors, some deception, you know, as I know, Coach Byrne from like Harvard would call it, like, setting an up pick on the high corner, then kicking it across the field to another single, to a single guy, dodging a short stick downhill and trying to create a little bit of a 3-on-3 type of approach on that side. That was how we could get separation and get some leverage. Now, as Thomas McConvey started to settle into to our offense here, he was such a force to be reckoned with, and some really slick Canadians. We just try to be really fundamental with ball movement, really smart with our shot selection, work for really high percentage shots. We didn't really have an outside shooter until 2021 when we brought in Michael McCormick, who could shoot 111 miles an hour, a transfer that we got from Middlebury. He could stretch the defense. Wow. But up until then, we didn't have any stretch shooters. So everything had to be, again, crashing the crease on rebounds, you know, getting ridebacks, trying to score an early offense, that type of thing, because our 6-on-6 was pretty, you know, just pretty monotonous. It was just pretty kind of wear you down over time. And we had good faceoff guy. We had an All-American faceoff guy, Tommy Burke. So we could feed the beast, and we had a good defense. So we didn't beat ourselves, but I wouldn't say we were a high octane offense. We didn't have those guys. So every year that we've gotten here, you know, we've been able to push the envelope a little bit more and, you know, really compliment our Canadians. We're kind of two-handed Americans, so we couldn't be contained to one side of the field, just allow ourselves to swing the ball to both sides and be a little more dynamic that way. But Danny now is doing an amazing job of mixing in some more traditional sets, like a 1-4-1, some top dodging 1-4-1. Again, going from like a single crease to a multiple man crease on the fly, kind of confusing people's recoveries. He's doing a good job of what I want, which is being multiple, you know, having a couple of things that we can transition to that are very simple, but when the defense is not ready in the same possession, you know, we can catch people off guard and create some goal scoring opportunities.
So when you say being multiple, it's an intentional, we're going to go from a one crease to a two crease to an open. Is it a flow where they can just do it however they want to, or is it actually something that they communicate, or is it scripted?
Yeah. So there'll be a set starter. Like a lot of these offense, there'll be a set starter and say, hey, we're going to run this play. And, you know, if we don't get any leverage off of that, then we can go into a big little, we can run some razor picks, see how they play that. And then we can kick it back up top. Now we've got a short stick in a position down low where maybe he's on a pipe or he's a fill and they're not as good in the off ball positions. And he gives them a tremendous amount of trust, right? We want to work all week to give them the keys on game day and let them go out and make the plays. So they have audibles, they have calls as it relates to where they're starting the offense from on the field, where it's going to start. And as it relates to their adjacent player, like if they're going to run a flyby or if they're going to run a pass down, pick down, or they're going to run a flip pass, you know, he gives them a lot of little audibles that they can call throughout the possession to freelance within the possession.
Mm-hmm. What do you think the biggest key to teaching two-man game is?
Great question.
Whether that be concepts, drills, the coverages you provide.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's probably change of speed and spacing, you know, change of speed and spacing, kind of just like manipulating the off-ball defender, trying to create a little bit of a 2-on-1 and just being really savvy with, you know, where you're setting the pick and how you're setting the pick and how you separate from the pick, you know, creating that ability to throw back or to deny the pick and get underneath. So if your defenseman is not, as we say, outworking the picker, if he's being lazy, there's some ways that, you know, you can create some easier separation. And if he's working really hard, then maybe you deny the pick and you just allow yourself to go 1-on-1. So I don't have, you know, all the answers there, but as I said, I think it's change of speed and spacing with the pick location.
How often do you guys change pick coverages defensively, whether it be for yourself or for the sake of the offense, learning how to play against different coverages?
We don't change it a lot. We try to keep things really, really simple on defense. I'm fine with what we do defensively being very vanilla because I want it to be pretty interchangeable. So when offensive middies, like we're very big on stopping transition, offensive middies getting in the hole, I want them to feel really confident when they play defense. So we do a lot of drills where they have to play defense and kind of a getting in transition, defending for a certain amount of time and then getting off field, those type of things, us supporting them defensively. We play picks pretty much pretty universal in terms of if it's above goal line or below goal line, but with the shot clock era, we made play picks a certain way with short time versus the first layer of the offense. So if it's deep in the shot clock and we're really just focusing on speed of play, we may switch everything, you know, or we may, you know, try to dog everything, get guys through so we can maintain those matchups. But we, again, try to keep it super simple so that we don't have too many situations. I mean, you know, I'm always impressed when we play like, you know, Ivy Leagues or these other teams that they do a variety of different defenses. And I, to me, that's just not how I teach. It's not work for me, but some people it works really well. So I definitely see the value in changing it up in practice too. But for us, we keep it pretty simple.
What about for the sake of the offense?
Yeah. So for the sake of the offense, we really pride ourselves on the preparation piece where we have the scout team watch almost more film than the offense does to replicate what that defense is going to do for us that week and how they play picks. So they really buy in really hard in terms of emulating certain players, certain short sticks, certain poles, how they play picks, and trying to give our offense different looks in the spring. I don't think we do a ton of that in the offseason in the fall, but we really do give them different looks every week in the spring.
So from a scout perspective, but not necessarily the development during the course of the whole year.
No, we don't.
Got it. What is your sort of, what would you say your philosophy is on man up?
I mean, man up, I give the full reins to Danny, so I don't want to, you know, speak for him and what we do there, but I would just say spacing and ball movement. You know, those are the two biggest things for me is you got to have a great point guy and you got to have a great crease guy. If you have those two guys, you can really do a lot in terms of, you know, adapting to what defense they're throwing at you and having a guy that can distribute and swing the ball to both sides. But we try to keep it pretty simple there. Again, maybe one set change, keep the defense on its toes, have really good spacing. It all comes down to two-on-ones, right? I mean, this is not reinventing the wheel. Yep. It's just keeping good spacing, moving the ball efficiently, having, you know, six guys engaged in the possession at one time so that we're just popping the ball around and creating really high percentage shots, not settling for an outside shot within the first 10 seconds of a possession. If anything, I think I heard from Matt Brown or that Denver likes to, you know, maintain possession first. So it's like, we don't need to take a shot man up. We can still soften the defense with a really good long man up approach, but that's just the defensive coach and me thinking about that.
So
totally. I'm always open to new philosophies though, if you have one.
No, I mean, I think I don't think it's reinventing the wheel. I think everything you're saying is sort of what I think too. I just think that it's fun to listen to how people articulate it. And if we were to ask you on the flip side, you know, when you're guarding various man ups, you know, why is it we don't see a whole lot of one behind man ups compared to the point guy in a 3-3 or a drop down? Do you have any idea why? Is it a lot? Do you find it a lot harder to cover a 3-3 or a drop downs 3-3 than a one behind, or is it personnel based? Like if you have, you know, Steel Stanwyck or somebody that's a very two-handed, incredible feeder, would you do more of that?
I don't know. It seems like one thing I noticed in the PLL this year, in transition, especially with the face-off, the new face-off rule, was them just keeping all six guys above goal line and just giving yourself another option. Yep. Just to score quickly. And I kind of think of the same way with man up where, I mean, it's great to have a feeder at X. If you have a guy that can sneak the pipes and play the cat and mouse game, I think there's a tremendous amount of value in that. But on short penalties, I'd rather have all six guys above engaged. And if we have good spacing and we have good ball movement and we have at least one set change, we're going to be able to create some leverage somewhere. I don't want to, again, take a guy out of the mix where if they try to pressure one of our corners or pressure one of the adjacent passes, it just makes it a little bit easier to take that X guy out of the equation when the ball's above.
Well, I think also you can definitely have a very, very good man up without having any two-handed guys. Maybe it'll give you more versatility to have a really two-handed guy that you could push the other direction with, whatever set, and be able to get fades up the wings and rotations in front. And, you know, those types of plays are nice to have.
Yeah.
Not necessary, but yeah.
Now, to your point, I love, you know, starting like a 1-3-2 and just like pushing a corner and mirroring off the crease and just like a quick swing through X while you get a ball side seal slip, you know, as you kick it up the wing, like just switching fields like that really quickly, especially if you do it to like the short stick side where they're not really as buttoned up. Sometimes you might be able to get an easy little quick hitter. So I see the value there for sure.
Yeah. And the little reversal, you know, the X to the wing back to the X guy reversal with a feeder that can do it to both sides can be tricky. It depends on how you want to guard it, but there's a really good chance you're getting some kind of a skip or throwback.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. What's your preference man down wise? Five man? Classic?
We just try to honestly kind of sit in a house and not rotate, you know. Just yeah. We've had some goalies in the past that we could just kind of pack it in and just try not to rotate and just drop and pass carries and just stay in our shape and
like a string.
String the point guy a little bit, you know. More so string from the wings and less from the pipes. Last year, my old defensive coach was really kind of stringing more from the pipes up. But this year we're a little bit more from the wings. I'm actually switching it up a lot more, going from, you know, kind of a box and one into a five man and things like that. So we're actually experimenting. Like, we put the short stick at the point this fall, seeing how the short stick at the point works, being a little bit more aggressive with him out top. And philosophy wise, I really don't have a huge preference. I think my preference defensively in general is to not create offense. So if we can do less is more, get really good at picking off passes, get really good at contesting shots, get really good at, you know, communicating and committing to hard rotations when we do have to rotate, just being on a string and being really consistent with that. But as I said, I'm not a super complex thinker. I like to keep it super simple so that I can teach it.
Yeah. You mentioned a minute ago that you watched the PLL, and you're mentioning, you know, keeping guys in front of the net and in transition situations. I love watching too. I watched 80% of the games this year, usually after the fact. But what did you learn? What are some of the other things that you noticed that you know that you thought were interesting that you're considering, you know, doing or not, but just interesting stuff that you've kind of noticed from PLL players individually or the schematically?
Well, first of all, I'm with you. I love watching the PLL. I think, unfortunately, this was the least amount of PLL that I've watched this summer just due to personal conflicts. I can't even tell you why I didn't watch as much of it this year, but I'm glued to the TV every weekend with PLL. I like to watch every game, even if it's on replay. I just admire the skill level, the speed of play. I love the rules with a shorter field and just creating more transition. I love how good the goalies are. I love how good, you know, the offense is and how dynamic the offense is. I really focus more on just kind of their scheme, like what are the sets that they're running. Like, it seemed like last summer there was a lot of, you know, two-man game on one side and a three-man wheel on the other side and just one X guy to kind of be a swing guy and just a lot of just kind of creative spacing and just reading each other and reacting, a lot of read and react offense. And whereas last season, I thought we saw a lot more of that, just kind of two man and then three man. And even in the club circuit on the summer circuit, people were kind of emulating that. Whereas, like, you know, this summer, it seemed to be, you know, a little bit more basic. I didn't see as many crazy things, but I did, again, I think I just admire the good players. Like, I love watching, you know, Mac O'Keefe on the Archers, like, the value that he added to their team. You know, I loved watching the Water Dogs, like how freaking good they are as like a team, you know, and just how the seasons that they've been having. Also, personally, just love watching the Archers because I love watching my guy Warren Jeffrey and play defense with Graham Hossick and how buttoned up and physical and tough their defense was, and Latrell Harris and all those guys. Like, I try to watch the defenses a lot too and just see how they, you know, they don't slide a whole lot, you know? So how do they survive in a world with so many good players when they don't have to slide? Obviously their goalies are phenomenal, you know, but also, you know, how do they do it? So that's what I'm always looking for.
Yeah, I agree. It's so cool to watch. I mean, it seems defensively, they just tie people up and double you.
Yeah.
Just something that, you know, that was a topic I wanted to ask you about. I've been sort of noticing just how much holding is going on.
Yeah.
In pro and college lacrosse. Out of shorties, out of poles. I mean, those cannons, short sticks. Unbelievable.
Yeah, unbelievable.
At being disruptive and holding the crap out of you.
Uh-huh.
But you know, just getting people hooked in a reverse V-hold or a V-hold, getting them stuck in there. Speaking of players I like to watch is your boy, Jack Rowlett.
Oh, man, he's awesome. He's a beast.
I love watching him play, man.
Yeah.
It's really
he's a terror. I mean, that guy plays like just so free. Like, you can tell that when Jack's playing, he's just in the moment. He's always just playing in the moment. He's just always super loose and super confident and just flying around making aggressive plays. And he throws like crazy checks, but he finds a way to land them. And he's just super effective, man. I just love his motor.
No doubt. Off ball too. The timing, his double teams, the way he hunts you down, you know, it's really cool and interesting to watch. But watching these players and watching what they do, the physicality of the Dodgers, you know, that's something that, like, you know, people just, I don't think realize, even, you know, even at the highest levels of Division I lacrosse, I mean, physicality is it. If you're not being physical, you're probably not going to be able to play. And that it's, you know, can you speak to that a little bit as to how you guys sort of
emphasis on that? I really can't. So we just watched our, at least one of our scrimmages so far from this past weekend. We played Stony Brook and Yale, and you know, we gave up a number of goals against Stony Brook because we just weren't making good contact with Dodgers. We weren't getting our hands on Dodgers, you know, and yes, we were forcing them to lower percentage areas of the field, but we were having to slide way too much and way too early because we weren't taking them off their line. We weren't making them have to re-dodge or re-square or change their angle of approach. And just with simple ball movement, they were beating our rotations. They were beating our throwbacks. They were doing a really good job. I give them a lot of credit. And, you know, I said a huge point of emphasis for us as it relates to the, you know, for a lack of better term, the tip of the spear, the point of contact, the short sticks on ball or the LSMs on ball, is how do we set ourselves up to make good contact with our approaches? How are we playing our angles? You know, those type of things. And we want to be physical without fouling. I think the best man down units in the country are the ones that don't have to defend a whole lot. The teams that really minimize their penalties with just stupid stick checks and just stupid stuff. So we're very disciplined with how we teach our short sticks to approach with their stick head upfield and how we slide with, you know, skewering, leading with our stick first, those types of things, not coming with some heavy chop or not coming with some high cross check. These are little details that I think coaches glance over and they think that, you know, just being physical and being tough, it's going to work out in the long run. Well, I kind of feel like it deteriorates your defense over time. If you're not a stickler on these little things, you know, of how to be physical without fouling, you're going to hurt yourself in the long run. So we do emphasize, you know, winning our matchups. And what I tell my polls is, like, we want to be strong on ball. So being strong on ball means you're not getting run by. It means you're not giving leverage by throwing checks and getting your hands pinned to your body, or throwing checks and stopping moving your feet and getting run by. Being strong on ball means taking great approaches by anticipating the ball movement, taking good angles and getting out on guys at your desired point of contact, not theirs. So if they want to start their offense at the 45 yard line, that's fine. They can, but I may not meet them until the top of the box at 20 yards. Or if they're going to climb the ladder and I can see them starting their offense a mile away, we may go shut the top of the ladder so they can't even climb the ladder, or the swing guy, go shut that guy so they can't swing the ball. Little things like that, I think, can negate the unnecessary physicality just by being smart and anticipating how you want to dictate them getting into a flow.
I got a question about physicality defensively. How do you distinguish between, if at all, between trying to use a Dodger's momentum against them by bumping them when they're trying to run around you to get them off track versus when they're smashing into you, in which if you try to smash a guy who's smashing into you, they'll spin, bounce, or hezzy right by you? Where I've been thinking about it in terms of soaking that physicality and dampening their momentum to use their momentum against them when they're coming into you, rather than trying to drive somebody out. When you drive somebody out that's coming into you, they're going to spin, bounce, or hezzy right by you. Have you thought about that? How do you think about that?
So the question what that makes me think of is, you know, some of our D middies we've recruited have been football players, whether it be quarterbacks or safeties or linebackers, or even, you know, cornerbacks. And we just talk about, like, bump and run coverage, like you're saying. Like, we're not trying to make, you know, aggressive, you know, contact on the Dodger. We're trying to, like you said, absorb their contact, take them off their line by basically splitting their line, getting your feet on either side of their line or shading one side of the line to make them go to their weak end. And even if they S dodge because you're so far away from the cage, that's fine. If we're doing a good job of absorbing contact, that should allow us to drop step and then simultaneously run with them. You know, if we're trying to just, like, lunge and explode ourselves into the Dodger, even if we do make a contact, A, we could foul them, or B, we have to stop our feet because you have to engage your feet to apply that pressure. So the good contact, as we call it, is being able to apply the pressure or absorb the pressure, but also maintain your ability to run with a Dodger. So, that's kind of how we think about it. And what I was saying with the film today was, like, we weren't even getting bump and run coverage. We were taking these like perfect angles on paper and going away and taking away topside. But if you literally draw a line from where they start their dodge to the pipe, it's a straight line. Yeah. So it's like, how do you, where are you going to cut them off on that line when they're at 15 yards and you got to slide immediately? Or are you going to make them go off that line when they start their dodge?
Yeah.
So at least if they start their dodge,
split their line. Yeah.
That's right.
Run, use their momentum against them.
That's right.
I'm talking about absorbing it and dampening it. I'm talking about more of like when they're on the island and they're coming into you now.
Gotcha.
As opposed to out wide where it's like, all right, they're trying to get around, you bump them wider. But when they're coming into you, Jack Rellet's a great example of this because he's not bigger than everybody. So he actually has to absorb contact. Like if you watch him, he'll sort of swing a reverse V-hold around, but you'll notice he's giving ground. Mm-hmm. As other guys, you'll notice they're trying to like jack the crap out of people and push them or hard slap lift. And all they're doing is getting spun on or they're whipping them around with V-holds as opposed to sort of capturing them. It's almost the equivalent of using their momentum against them by pulling a chair out from underneath somebody.
Love that analogy.
They get knocked down. So that is the other sort of side of using somebody's momentum against them. And it usually is happening more like on the island.
Yeah.
Because you're not going to sort of have a point of contact like that way far out. You're going to have a cushion. And
that's right.
Once they make a move, you'll bump them. That's different than sort of absorbing that. You know, it's like a hang up. You know, how are you going to guard somebody in a hang up when it's you against them? You know, if you try to smash them, they're going to bounce, spin, or hez you right by you. So that was one thought I was curious about.
Yeah. Too. Yeah. I mean, on the island, I guess it depends on how your defense is predicated, right? If you're a crease sliding defense, if you're rolling guys underneath, then it can be really, you know, can be really good in a sense to get that V hold and just kind of rip them through and just use that kind of leverage that way. We're a team that we don't slide to our poles from behind the cage, and we're going to drive guys upfield. So it's really crucial that we get them early. And if we don't get them early, once they get to the island, it's really keeping great helmet level, not leaning your helmet onto the guy's shoulder where, like you said, they can step away and pull the chair out from under you, but keeping great helmet level, keeping them basically your hands on their strike zone at a 90 degree angle, you know, as I learned from Coach Torpy at High Point, really maintaining that leverage from your legs and your core and just trying to drive them out that way. I mean, literally in the game on Sunday, Stony Brook guy posted up, our top defenseman on the island was going back and forth. And he literally shot it behind the back and put it in a tiny little corner. And it was an amazing play, but there really wasn't much we could do there unless we were going to blindside double. You know, we just didn't really have much we could do. So I guess it kind of depends on how you play your defense, help defense.
Right. And you're going to have to live with something.
You're going to have to give up. Let's beat our poles 10 times a game. Good luck.
Exactly. All right. Last topic. Just talk a little bit about Vermont and give your elevator pitch on what's great about it and what you're building and what you're excited about.
Yeah. Well, first things first, you know, I've been here 8 years and I just signed a 4-year extension and it's a school that I really believe in and a program that I believe our best milestones are still ahead of us. You know, we've accomplished a lot in 8 years and really proud of the things that we've done, but not satisfied by any means. And I think we're in a great position to take the next step as a program and compete for more conference championships and hopefully take it beyond a first round NCAA game. But the reason why I really believe in Vermont is it just has a great balance that a lot of lacrosse schools don't have, where you get very much in a silo with just academics and just lacrosse, and you really don't have any way to blow off steam. And, you know, a thing that we talk a lot about now in college athletics is mental health, you know, and how do we maintain good mental health? And part of that is not just having all your social life, you know, revolve around drinking or going to the bar or going to parties. Let's have healthy activities. Let's go to the lake. Let's go play golf. Let's go for a hike. You know, there's a lot of things that Vermont has to offer within 5 minutes of campus that other schools don't, where you can blow off steam in a healthy way and bond with your teammates. And I think that really helps galvanize our locker room. When you have 15 guys on a Friday that want to go play golf together, or, you know, we started the hunting and fishing club at Vermont when guys want to go, you know, fly fishing in upstate New York and they want to drive, you know, across the lake. I think those are really cool aspects of being a Vermont lacrosse player that don't involve lacrosse or academics. So that really helps us, I think, achieve more in the classroom, but also in the locker room, because guys get to see who they truly are, not just as defined by how many goals they score or how high their GPA is, but also as, you know, hey man, like other things. It's okay to have different interests. And so I try to recruit, guys that are from all over the country. We have a wide variety of backgrounds here at Vermont. It's a high destination school, over 70% out-of-state students. So it's a cool place to meet people from all over the country and to meet teammates from all over the country, but also have an expectation to win lacrosse games and fight for championships and get a great, education in the process with a really strong network all over the country. And so really excited about the future of Vermont and just need to continue to recruit great people here.
It's awesome. Seems like everybody loves Vermont.
Nah, you don't meet many people that don't, and if you've lived here as long as I have, you realize why.
Yeah. I think it's really interesting too, that you have a school that allows you to have more than just a lacrosse experience, an academic experience. I mean, having had kids at schools, where it's awesome, but it's pretty much a job. It's right. Just you go, and it's not bad. You love your job, but that's really what it is. You don't get. I mean, I remember going. I went to Brown. I had friends that were not lacrosse players, like a lot of them. In fact, I had almost the equal amount of just like lots of different friends. I was in a fraternity. It was different. It was the 80s. We didn't have the same social media. Thank God. But do you find that Vermont gives you a balance there? Because I think it's a very healthy balance when you talk about mental health. Because all of a sudden everything in your world just revolves around your playing time and how you're doing and your grades. And instead of being able to just do something completely different and just, like at home, not every friend has to be a lacrosse player. Right. So why wouldn't it be that way in college?
I agree. I mean, as it relates to just training lacrosse and becoming a resilient lacrosse team, I encourage my players I saw this quote not too long ago, to seek discomfort. To really, getting up early and practicing at 6 a.m., pushing yourself really hard in what seems like a meaningless conditioning session, coming in on a Wednesday and just emptying the tank in the weight room. All of those things help you build up that resilience that you need to be a great lacrosse team. But you also have to have a balance. And Vermont just gives you so many tools at your disposal. When I can literally look out my dorm and look at a beautiful mountain, Mount Mansfield, that I can go ski on later that day, or, right down the road from where I practice every single day, there's a beautiful golf course I can go play golf, or just get yourself in the outdoor space. I'm big on the outdoor world, and I just love being out in the woods. I'm in the state park almost every day with my golden retriever. And, it's just a great way to kind of focus and think about the day, reflect and be mindful. And all that leads to good mental health, man. So, there's a lot of great schools out there. There's a lot of great lacrosse programs out there. But the thing that sets Vermont apart is just the balance of the experience.
Yeah. And it's a fun place.
It's a fun place.
No doubt. Chris, thank you so much for coming on, man. I really enjoyed this conversation. I've been looking forward to it for a while, and I'm glad we finally got it done.
Likewise.
Luck this season. Have an awesome end of the fall. Enjoy your new baby boy, Stone Fights.
Thank you very much. And, that's right.
We'll be in touch sometime soon.
All right. Sounds good. Thank you very much, Jamie.
All right, man. Thanks, Chris. Take care.
Thank you. Bye-bye.